Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
That is exactly what I needed to hear.
Thank God someone here knows what they're talking about.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride. All
right, you need to take the time and get the full picture.
I love the ladies. I mean, they rev my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom. It is Anchor Man, not Anchor Lady.
What do you want from me? I'm not a married
sweetheart. Goodness sake, kid. Keep your voice down. Your father's listening to the radio.
I'm not a married sweetheart.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Thank you for joining us. What a crazy week it is. This is Amy Coney Barrett week, and right now, Senator Coons is questioning. Yep, he's still going. Senator Coons is questioning Amy Coney Barrett. We might dip in to hear some of what he said. There have been some headliners today. I know, Ryan, you were saying Amy Klobuchar was really invigorating to your American pride listening to your favorite Democrat senator speak. Did I hear that wrong?
misinterpreted, I would say. But oh, I was impressed with the back and forth because I thought Amy Coney Barrett did a great job. But I also thought she did a good job. I thought she did what she's supposed to do in a normal Senate hearing.
Okay, I think that's a very good assessment. So we've been watching Ted Cruz has gone. That was very good. His response to, Sheldon Whitehouse, I think Sheldon Whitehouse so far is maybe the loser in my completely objective assertion about how this has gone so far. But I think that it's important that we talk a little bit about what we've heard so far and what the impact is going to be. So here are the senators who have gone up to this point. Obviously, Lindsey Graham is the chairman. He went first. I think he did a good job of his responsibilities there. And we had Dianne Feinstein went next. Then Grassley, Patrick Leahy put us all to sleep, but John Cornyn woke us back up again. And then Dick Durbin went, Mike Lee, Sheldon Whitehouse, Ted Cruz, Amy Klobuchar, Ben Sasse, and now Chris Coons. Up next, after we get done with Coons, is Josh Hawley. And we are going to carry the full part of that for you here, and we are very excited to do that. In the meantime, real quick, before we move on here, Katie and Ryan, both of you, what is your, like, there's an election taking place. In the meantime, like this is, there are so many gigantic things happening in our country right now. And one of them is the campaign. Last night, we talked a little bit earlier about the president's rally, which was ridiculous and awesome and very Trumpian. And, you know, everything that you expect of him, it was there last night. We see Joe Biden moving around the country in his bus and nobody, like people are not showing up for these events. Shockingly not showing up for these events. So does that translate? Katie, play cut number five here real quick and listen to Joe Biden react to this statistic. I think Ryan pointed this one out the other day.
Gallup reported last week 56% of Americans said that they were better off today than they were 4 years ago and would have been under the Obama-Biden administration. So why should people who feel that they are better off today under the Trump administration vote for you?
Well, if they think that, they probably shouldn't.
56% of Americans think they're better off today under the Trump administration than 4 years ago. The reporter asked Joe Biden, why should they vote for you? And he said, well, if they think that, they probably shouldn't. 56%, folks. Here's a statistic that people don't talk about very much. Do you know that Donald Trump got a higher percentage of the vote than Bill Clinton?
No.
I did not know that.
Bill Clinton got 43% of the vote. And I remember being, that was the 90s. I was in grade school, in like intermediate and junior high. Sorry, folks. But I remember the gripes from people, going, he didn't even get a majority of the vote, you know, like that kind of thing. And I just saw that statistic put out there before that yesterday. 43% of the vote for Bill Clinton, because that was, you know, a three-way race, and yeah, it made an actual difference. Kanye West is out there telling everyone to start voting in Kentucky and to write himself in. What do you think he's doing? Katie, why do you think he's still on this? Is it just to help Trump? Is it just his ego?
Oh, I think it's total ego. I think it's total pride. He put it out there into the universe that he wants to run and that he's going to do it and that he's going to win. And I mean, he's got a big ego just like Trump. And so if he has
Kanye
West, if he has,
who has the bigger ego?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Gosh, I don't know. I think that Trump has, I think he has had to have some humility, I think, because of the media and
because Geraldo Rivera.
Because of Geraldo.
Yeah, told him singularly because of Geraldo.
But more humble in his recovery from COVID.
Trump took a position that obviously some people are very, very not happy with who he is and how he's representing. So he had to have some humility, whereas Kanye West has never had to have that.
Well, we are going to take a quick break right here, and I would love to know what you think. Who has the bigger ego? Is it Kanye West or Donald Trump? Join us on the Facebook page, the Annie Fry Show Facebook page, and the Annie Fry YouTube page, and you can comment there. We're going to take a very quick break, and we come back. We are going to bring you the very beginning of Senator Josh Hawley as he engages in the questioning of Amy Coney Barrett. We're going to be back in just a few minutes with the full questioning from Josh Hawley. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. I can almost hear Josh Hawley singing this Josh Turner song, can't you? Josh Hawley has this surprising low resonance to his voice. It's very present. And he is on Capitol Hill right now, and he has engaged in his questioning portion of the confirmation process of Amy Coney Barrett for the Supreme Court. Let's listen in from the beginning. Your Missouri Senator Josh Hawley.
Judge, it's good to see you again. I've been so impressed with your answers today. It's really quite extraordinary. I look forward to visiting with you a little bit here. Can we just start on the topic of independence, picking up where Senator Coons just was questioning you? I've heard my Democrat colleagues over and over again suggest that because, I guess, you clerked for Justice Scalia, that you'll automatically vote however he did. They attribute his opinions to you, his decisions to you, his method to you. Did Justice Scalia tell you what to do in your career? I mean, have you been in the habit your life of doing exactly what Justice Scalia told you to do in your professional career?
Well, Senator Hawley, as I said earlier, if you confirm me, you're getting Justice Barrett, not Justice Scalia. You know, I share his method of interpreting the text, but, you know, I didn't agree with him in every case, even when I was clerking. I mean, then he could tell me what to do, and even if I disagreed, I had to go his way. But the fact that we share the same approach does not mean that we would always reach the same result.
And you make up your own mind, don't you?
I do make up my own mind.
And you have your own views, I think it's fair to say. Is that accurate?
Indeed, I do.
And you're a very accomplished jurist in your own right. Is that fair to say?
Well, it feels a little immodest to opine on that.
Well, I'll say it is. You're very accomplished. So I think this one-way attribution that everything that you must just be a whatever Justice Scalia did, you would automatically do, I have to say, frankly, I think is a little bit demeaning. Let me ask you about some other attacks that you've endured today. Now, I noticed yesterday we were assured that you would not be attacked on the basis of your faith. I noticed that didn't last 24 hours. But I'm not surprised, because for 3.5 years we have heard consistent attacks from the Democrat side on nominees on the basis of their faith, including, of course, you, Judge Barrett, and we talked about this some yesterday. Today, the second Democrat senator to speak criticized you for speaking to a Christian legal group that has a summer program for Christian law students, where you gave, I think, a lecture once or twice on constitutional and statutory interpretation. So let me just ask you about that. You've talked about your faith. This has been well established. You accepted an invitation to speak to a group of Christian law students on the topic of your specialty. Tell us why you accepted the invitation.
I had several other colleagues who had participated in the Blackstone program lecturing, and I heard great things about it from them. We had a contingent of students from Notre Dame regularly attend this program, and they were among our most engaged and smartest students. And I went and did it. The first time I did it, I really enjoyed it. The students were very, very engaged. So I did it, I don't know, I might have done it 4 or 5 times. Each summer I would go and just give a lecture on originalism that was 1 hour of the, you know, Blackstone is a summer-long program. So I went and gave my 1 hour lecture at the beginning of it, and I really thought it was a fun to talk about the Constitution to an engaged group of students is fun for someone who's a law professor.
Are you aware of anything in the Constitution or our laws that say that it is a disqualification for office for a believer of religious faith to go and lecture to law students of a similar faith in her area of expertise?
I want to be careful that I'm not veering into answering hypothetical questions, but I certainly didn't think there was anything wrong with my going to speak to a group of Christian law students about my expertise.
Let me ask you this. Senator Leahy also raised a pledge, a statement that you signed regarding abortion. You told us, you told the committee in response to his question, you and your husband both signed it. I'm looking at the advertisement in question right here, the portion that you signed. You said that you signed it on your way out of church, if I remember correctly.
I did. That was almost 15 years ago. At the back of church, there was a table set up for people on their way out of Mass to sign a statement, validating their commitment to the position of the Catholic Church on life issues. The ad that was next to it, I don't recall seeing the ad at the time, and in context looking at it, it looks to me like that was an ad by the St. Joseph County Right to Life group. The statement that I signed, affirming the protection of life from conception to natural death.
And you just made reference to the fact again that it was in church. Can you just, why would it have been in the back of church? I mean, why would the signatures, why would this have been available to sign or not, as you so chose in the back of church?
Well, because that is the position of the Catholic Church, on abortion. Though I feel like I should emphasize here, as I emphasized to others asking me the question, that I do see as distinct my personal moral religious views and my task of applying the law as a judge.
Is it safe to say, following that distinction you just made, though, that the signature that you lent your husband also reflects your understanding of your church's teaching and your own personal views? I mean, that's what this says that you signed.
So what I would like to say about that is I signed that almost 15 years ago in my personal capacity when I was still a private citizen, and now I'm a public official. And so while I was free to express my private views at that time, I don't feel like it is appropriate for me anymore because of the canons of conduct to express an affirmative view at this point in time. But what that statement plainly says is that when I signed that statement, that is what I was doing at that point as a private citizen.
And I'm not aware of any law or provision of the Constitution that says that if you are a member of the Catholic Church and adhere to the teachings of the Catholic Church, or you have religious convictions in line with those of your church teaching, that you're therefore barred from office. Are you aware of any constitutional provision to that effect?
I would think that the Religious Test Clause would make it unconstitutional.
Well, let me just ask you about the test clause since you bring it up. Article 6 says, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Can you just give us your sense, as a constitutional expert, scholar, and judge now, of the significance of Article 6 for our constitutional scheme?
So the Religious Test Clause prohibits this body, prohibits the government generally from disqualifying people from office because of their religious beliefs.
And it guarantees, does it not, the freedom of religion? I mean, it is Amendment 1, the First Amendment, will go on to talk explicitly, and I want to ask you about that in a second, about religious liberty. But Article 6 is significant in that it sets out that One cannot be, no American citizen can be kept out of office based on his or her belief. You don't have to go and get someone's approval, certainly not somebody in government, their approval over what you believe. Does it meet this test or not? Do they like it or not? You don't have to get any sign-off. In fact, any kind of sign-offs are explicitly ruled out by the Constitution. Is that a fair characterization?
The religious test clause makes plain that denomination or belief can't be a reason to disqualify someone.
And that is why I continue to say it is vital that we underline in the Constitution that this test clause, and that we insist that it be applied in the context of your confirmation, Judge, and every nominee for every high office who comes before this committee. There are no religious tests for office, and the attempt to smuggle them in, even in the midst of this committee's hearings to date, it must be resisted on the basis of the Constitution itself. Let me ask you about the First Amendment, about the free exercise of religion. That's, of course, how the First Amendment begins. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Tell me what you think this says about the place of religious observance in American life and its significance. Why is it protected like this in the First Amendment? What do you draw from that?
I mean, I think its presence in the Bill of Rights, you know, like all of our rights, shows that it was one that the people, for generations, beginning in 1791, considered central to being a free people.
And there's no indication from the Constitution that religious believers are second-class citizens in any way, is there?
Well, the free exercise certainly suggests to the contrary.
And in fact, the free exercise clause and the First Amendment suggests that the exercise of religion, worship, religious belief gets special protection. I mean, it's singled out here for protection, along with immediately after speech, press, right of the people peacefully to assemble. Religion is given a special place, which the United States Supreme Court has recognized. Let me just ask you about attempts to disfavor religious believers on the basis of faith. Is it your understanding, can a government at any level, federal government, state government, municipality, whatever, can they treat religious believers differently? Can they single them out for disfavor versus a non-religious group? Is that permissible in our constitutional order?
Well, Senator Hawley, that's a complicated question because, you know, there's a lot of doctrine surrounding that, and there aren't bright line rules. And so that question would come up in a case with facts, and, you know, it would require the whole judicial decision making process. So it's not a hypothetical that I can answer.
Let me ask you about the court's decision, unanimous decision in the Hosanna Tabor case, which touches some of these questions, in which the court there, it's a question about church's ability, any house of worship, to hire and fire their ministers or those who perform religious functions, religious services. And in that unanimous decision, the court says that houses of worship are different, that they are unique, that they are given special protection under the First Amendment, and that therefore they must be accorded special status. They have to have the ability, for instance, to hire and fire ministers, those who are going to perform religious functions. The state, the government, cannot interfere with that. Do you agree with the teaching of that case? I mean, do you think that case remains good law and is a significant decision?
Well, Senator Hawley, I think the way to answer that question is, again, as I've said, I can't grade precedent, but I can talk about a precedent from my court. So I was on a panel that decided a case called Gruscott, which applied Hosanna Tabor to the situation of a Jewish school which had fired a teacher, and the teacher sued, and the question was whether, following Hosanna Tabor, that school was entitled to treat her as a minister under the ministerial exemption recognized in Hosanna Tabor. And my court, the panel that I was on, said that she was a minister, and we, you know, took the factors in Hosanna Tabor and said nothing was a bright line test. You look at the cluster, because Hosanna Tabor was designed to give religious institutions the freedom to hire and fire their ministers, you know, in this case, one of the Jewish faith, as consistent with their practice of their faith. And that view of ours in Gruscott was embraced by the Supreme Court last term in Our Lady of Guadalupe.
I think it's vital in this time, in this season, Judge, where we're seeing many challenges to religious independence, many challenges to the ability of churches to conduct worship on equal terms with secular organizations, that the Supreme Court's unanimous decisions in this area, Hosanna Tabor and others, the Trinity Lutheran case, which was not unanimous, but is a recent, very important case as well, I will just say for myself that I think that the lines that the Supreme Court has drawn regarding the First Amendment, regarding the status of houses of worship, regarding the rights of religious believers, that now more than ever, it is vital that those be respected and that the Constitution be fully enforced, and that the line of cases that is now multi-years old that the Supreme Court has set out be followed. And I certainly hope that that you will respect and apply that precedent going forward. I don't have any reason to think that you won't. Let me shift gears and ask about another attack that has been made on you today, having to do with the Cantor case. The Cantor case, we've heard about, Senator Durbin asked you about it at some length, Senator Klobuchar asked you about it as well. The Cantor case, first of all, is a case about the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. Is that right?
That is right.
And it's about whether or not someone who had been charged with and convicted of or pled guilty to a felony could keep and bear arms under certain circumstances. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah.
Now, I've heard repeatedly from my Democrat colleagues that you write in your dissent, you dissented in this case, you write in your dissent that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right, but the right to vote is not an individual right. But maybe I'm reading a different opinion. That's not what you say in the opinion that I see. Page 50 of your opinion, or of the joint opinion, your dissent, you refer to civic rights, voting rights, as civic rights, and you say civic rights, you define them. Civic rights are individual rights. A moment later, you say, for example, the right to vote is held by individuals. So let's just set the record straight here. In this case, you say that the right to vote is an individual right. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the distinction between a civic right and the Second Amendment has to do with the purposes of that right. First of all, that's not a distinction you invented. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You were replying to both a chain of cases and also scholarship on this issue. Is that correct?
That is correct, and also the arguments the litigants made in the Cantor case itself.
And this designation of a civic right talks about what the right to vote, what its civic purposes are. In other words, it gives us a stake in our democracy. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
So you never at any point say that the right to vote is somehow secondary or less fundamental than any other right. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. I never said that.
In fact, your whole point in this case, which is a fundamental rights case, doesn't have anything to do with voting rights. This is not a voting rights case, is it, the Cantor case?
It
has nothing to do with voting rights. Your whole point in this case, a fundamental rights case, is that you think that your colleagues on the Seventh Circuit actually constricted fundamental rights too narrowly. That is, the Supreme Court of the United States has said in Heller that the right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right. That's the Heller decision. You think in this case that your colleagues actually were constraining that fundamental right a little too narrowly and were shutting some people out of it. Is that fair to say?
We did disagree about the scope of the right.
So just to make the record perfectly clear here, the Supreme Court has said, the United States Supreme Court has said over and over that voting, the right to vote, is a fundamental right. And I think you have affirmed that and recognized today, you've said that is Supreme Court precedent. Am I right about that?
Yes.
And the Supreme Court has said repeatedly that they adhere to the one person, one vote standard, the sort of baseline, the touchstone, the keystone to that entire doctrine. Do I have that correct?
Indeed, that is correct.
And nothing in your opinion challenges that or changes that or calls into question, critiques, nothing, right?
Not one iota.
Okay. I'm glad that we're clear on that. Now, Senator Durbin said in as part of his line of questioning on this, he suggested that, I don't know, perhaps that this your opinion in this case somehow, which has nothing to do with voting rights, makes you friendly to what he characterized as attempts to deny people the right to vote on racial grounds. He went on to say that we all come to, everybody, every judge, all of us who come to the law, every judge who comes to the bench, comes to the bench into cases with their own individual experience and viewpoints. So let's just talk about that for just a second, if we could, when it comes to the fraught but vital issue of race and your own experience with that. You and your husband are the parents of a multiracial family.
We are.
Can you give us some sense, just in your personal experience, what that has been like for you, what that means to you, what experience you bring to the bench because of your experience as a parent in this unique context?
Well, I think I could say how it has shaped me as a person. It has certainly, you know, whenever you have a life experience, it makes you acutely aware in your interactions with other people, you know, it gives you empathy for them. I mean, the same is true of our having a son with a disability. But I want to make very clear, Senator Hawley, that while my life experiences, I think, you know, I hope have given me wisdom and compassion, they don't dictate how I decide cases. Because, you know, as we discussed before and have discussed a couple of times, sometimes you have to decide cases in ways where you don't like the result. So while I hope that my family has made me a better person and my children definitely have given me new perspectives on life, I still, in applying the law and deciding cases, you know, don't let those experiences dictate the outcome.
You'll follow the law wherever the law leads.
Yes.
Which I think is a good way to bring us back full circle to where we started about your own independence. You've cultivated, I think it's fair to say, over the course of your very distinguished career, you've cultivated a reputation for original thinking, for independence, for courage and for toughness. And I see no evidence in your record that you've ever compromised, kowtowed, or bent your position to the whims of other people, especially people in power, based on what they wanted you to do or expected you to do or told you to do. Is that fair to say? I mean, have I missed something in your record?
No, I think that is fair to say.
I admire the way in which you've answered these questions, Judge, and your forthrightness on these issues, and I look forward to talking with you more tomorrow. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back my time.
Senator Josh Hawley doing, in my opinion, the best we've seen so far in having an actual meaningful conversation back and forth, asking the questions of Amy Coney Barrett the answers that are needed. And I'm going to tell you something. The only thing that I might have in common with Josh Hawley when it comes to professional understanding is knowing how to ask a good question of somebody. Sometimes you know exactly the answer to the question you're asking, but it's important that the person on the other end of the conversation answer that question. I guarantee you, Josh Hawley knew where every single question he fielded there, everywhere it was going, but gave Amy Coney Barrett to exemplify who she is, which is what you need to do in a confirmation hearing. Well done, Senator Josh Hawley. We are going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, more reaction. How about yours? 314-241-9797. 314-241-9797. We'll get your reaction here in just a minute. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Thanks for joining us today. It's been quite a day. The Senate confirmation hearing is going to resume soon, I guess. This is such a long day. Man, can you imagine being Amy Coney Barrett? She's been going since 8 a.m. Our time.
Ben Sasse was like, I don't know if this brings you relief or if it's bad, but I am the halfway mark.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And it's going to go tomorrow for a long, long day. And then Thursday, they will wrap up, I suppose, the closing statements. We're going to continue to cover this. Lynn says on Facebook, Annie, you're doing a great job. These days are difficult for Katie and Ryan and myself. We were just talking about this a little bit before. Like, does this show seem like it's been super long, or does it seem like it's gone by? Because we're starting at 11 a.m. Most of this week as we are doing the live coverage of the hearings. And it's something you can't really prepare for because you don't know what's going to happen that day. So we are in the midst of it. If any other news breaks during the show, we will bring it to you because we are reacting throughout the process of the hearing. We are making sure that we are keeping you up to date with anything that is developing. But the truth is that this is by far the major story. And after this week, there will be I think it's a 10-day possibly period of holding, and then they'll come back and vote. I believe that Lindsey Graham said, the date off of the top of my head is October 22nd. It's probably like a Sunday or something, and I'm wrong. But it's definitely, there's going to be a brief break in between. It's going to be like SCOTUS, 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 and then it's going to stop, and then we're going to come back and we're going to have the vote. The vote's going to be very dramatic, of course, as well. And it's just important to me And I think it's important to a lot of you, based on the feedback that we get from you, that you do have the opportunity to hear some of this meaty stuff for yourself and to be able to take us with you on 97.1 wherever you go. Ryan, what do you think about the ability to be able to provide people the opportunity to listen to this stuff in full, not just the clips that we want to pull, that when you're talking for 30 minutes long, it's always going to be out of some context, right? Otherwise, we'd be playing 5-minute clips, 6-minute clips, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I like listening to it live because you don't know what's going to happen. I thought, and maybe you guys disagree with this. I'm a guy, so maybe my opinion's going to be different here.
I'm a dude. Wrong.
I'm a dude. Amy Coney Barrett's a girl. I thought that they've treated her actually pretty respectfully. They haven't dove into her private life much, and that's maybe why I think this hearing has gone pretty well.
I think it's been substantive.
Yes, you know.
I think it's a good thing that I'm not up there trying to put my words together. It's a good thing I don't speak for a living.
Yeah.
I think that we have been able to see some real stuff and substance come out of this. I mean, when you go back to the Kavanaugh hearings, I don't remember anything about who he was or how he ruled or opinions that he wrote. I remember none of it. And I listened to every second of it. Mm-hmm. Right here on 97.1, we brought you all of that. I don't remember any of it. I just remember the Christine Blasey Ford stuff and the fact that he likes beer.
And Lindsey Graham just absolutely going bonkers. I remember that.
God, I hope you never get it. That was his line when he was talking about the Democrats, knowing what they would do with the power that they had. I want to highlight two here. When we go back, I tweeted this out yesterday. I talked to you about this yesterday. And this is striking to me specifically because with the emphasis that is being put on the Affordable Care Act right now, that is the big sore thumb that exists right now for Democrats. That is the consistency that they have right now in from person to person to person. The loss of the Affordable Care Act is a significant loss for these Democrats. Why is that? Is it because the Affordable Care Act was some amazing effort that was bipartisan, you know, championing the American people and helping the American people throughout the course of time? This is when we really got health care right. I don't know. I tweeted this out yesterday. It was something I was looking at while we were listening to the testimony. You need to remember that the ACA was extraordinarily partisan, the grandstanding by Senate Dems, that this is a largely embraced and loved plan is false. It wasn't. It never was, folks. It was beloved by the Democrats that passed it. The Democrats did this unilaterally and can't stand that they aren't in control right now to stop this from happening. And the reason why they aren't in control right now is because they did this. The Affordable Care Act passing, was it 2010? Set up, I think it was 2010, set up a domino effect of gained Republican control everywhere. No Democrat president, I think no president ever has lost more across the board seats for their party than Barack Obama did. And it's because of things just like this. The idea of universal health care, handing over everything to bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. when it comes to your personal health care. Give me a break. So here's the Affordable Care Act vote tally in the Senate. 60 yays. They got 60 votes for the Affordable Care Act, and every single one of them was Democrat. They had that much power, folks. And they've lost it. They've moved away from it because having that access, because the fact that they were not trustworthy with the power that they had. What are you looking at, Ryan? What are you interested in here?
I was looking for Ted Kennedy on there because remember, it was so unpopular when it passed that Ted Kennedy died right in the middle of all this happening, and Massachusetts elected Scott Brown, a Republican, to stop it. That's how unpopular it was.
Mm. Yeah, and let's see here, Scott Brown. He's not on here.
So this might have been the version that passed in between when Scott Brown was elected with the special election and after Ted Kennedy had died. I think that's what happened.
60 Democrats voted in favor of it. 39 Republicans voted against it, and one Republican didn't vote at all. Now, I want to take you also, I'm going to move you over to the House, because it's not just the Senate that makes bills here. Obviously, you need both. So let's go over to the House. The House had a significant Democrat majority. The House had a lot of Democrats in it. It wasn't razors thin. Guess what? 219 Democrats voted for it. 34 Democrats voted against it, and every Republican in the House voted against it. The only bipartisanship that existed regarding the Affordable Care Act was against it because it wasn't a good idea. And I guarantee you the majority of those Democrats that voted against it because they didn't have time to read the freaking bill. It's the classic Nancy Pelosi, we have to pass the bill so that we can see what is in it. You've got to be kidding me. So when you hear all these Democrats up on this dais here, and you hear them talking about how important it is that we protect the Affordable Care Act, that is protecting the Democrats and the Affordable Care Act. This is Democrat, this is Obamacare, this is not American healthcare. This is a very partisan version, which was only ever going to fully work in a single-payer system. That's the direction it was going. And there were even people, you remember the architect of this behind the scenes, said that the only way that this is ever going to function is if you basically lie to the people. He came out and he said that. And then the only way that this ever was made constitutional in the first place is by Roberts saying, yes, in fact, this penalty is a tax. And they said leading up to it, Obama said leading up to it, all of the people, all the Democrats leading this through Congress said, this is not a new tax. This is not a new tax. And Roberts said, oh, it's only legal. It's only constitutional if, in fact, it's a tax. It is a tax. Therefore, I'm making it constitutional. Obamacare lives on. The Supreme Court is super, super involved in that. It's because of the swing vote. The Republican Bush-appointed Supreme Court justice decided, and this is what Amy Coney Barrett has said today, that she said that the interpretation of the words is where you can differ. You can do a narrow reading. You can do a broad reading of a law. The Democrats sold the American people, as much as they ever did, on the idea that Obamacare was constitutional and that it wasn't a new tax. And the Supreme Court said it's only constitutional if it is a tax. And it's still here. So when you listen to these Democrats act like without Obamacare, healthcare does not exist, that's false. I will say this, though. Trump administration, get a clear, concise plan out there that people can understand. Get a messenger out there that can make sure that the American people know that when you move this out of the way, there's going to be something there that's better, that is more competitive, that allows insurance companies to compete across state lines so that the consumer is at the center of this picture. You know what Obamacare did? It guaranteed insurance companies customers. It said they have to come to you or we're going to penalize them with, yes, in fact, a tax. That's what Democrats do. They say, do what we want or we will tax you. And the Supreme Court said, yep, as long as it's a tax, it's fine. Do what Republicans do. Do what conservatives do. Make a consumer-driven, market-driven insurance plan that helps the American people, not the bureaucrats, not the insurance companies, and not the pocket line politicians that are sitting up there acting like they're waving their American flags and really they're benefiting from this on their own, the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, please. More tomorrow, but the DGS is coming up next. Thanks, guys, for watching.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.